This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, catching up with Austin Wintry, and it is so great to have a chance to talk again.
The pleasure's mine. Thank you. This is, I think, our 6,000th one of these.
I think so, yeah, but it's always, always fun, and there's always something just incredibly new and exciting to talk about, and this time it's your soundtrack for The Pathless, which is a game that's been created by Giant Squid and Matt Nava, and I can't wait to dive in and look under the hood, because it sounds like it was just an incredible process to get this soundtrack going.
They always are, but this one definitely, more than most, was just kind of a big undertaking, and it really wasn't advertised to be. It's always a deep dive. You know, Abzu, as constrained and concise as the game is, it was no small task to put together. But you know, the variables are pretty manageable. It's a linear game like Journey. You move very successively one area to the next, and so player movement is pretty predictable, which means that the extents of the interactiveness of the score are pretty, you can keep them in check relatively easily. It's still a complex challenge, but it's very different from an open world game.
So yeah, just by which virtue the Pathless of, is. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Just by virtue of that difference, even if The Pathless was a 90-minute game, which it most certainly is not, you would have a lot more kind of balls in the air to be juggling. And so still, even that said, it expanded quite a lot over the 3.5 years that I was working with them on it. But joyously, I was thrilled about that, because it was one of those that it only grew because it deserved to grow. No one wanted to make a game bigger than it needed to make, especially with Matt having worked on Flower, Journey, and Abzu as his three prior games, as art director on the first two and creative director on Abzu. You know, he's used to a game that wastes no time. It doesn't linger. It doesn't dawdle, you know? And so this one has the same philosophy, but it's just way bigger. So
yeah, it's a meaty game. And just ever so briefly, the story is you play as the hunter, this mysterious hunter who has an eagle companion, and she travels to an island, this kind of mysterious island that has been sort of, well, there's a darkness on the island, and there are all of these corrupted ancient spirits roaming around that she has to vanquish to bring the island back to its original state. And that's very simplistic, but, and I know there's more to it than that. But,
well, the beauty of it, I mean, just, you know, pausing on that specifically for a second, the thing that I love about it is that while all of that is true, and honestly, it could be that you play the whole game and then turn right around and say exactly what you just said. So in other words, it's not a BioWare game, you know, for example, where there's thousands of NPCs that have, you know, my sister this and I just lost my job and la la la, you know, like where there's just this kind of massive labyrinth of side stories and secondary and tertiary characters, etc. It is very straightforward in its storytelling. I've been calling it a playable myth, because I think of it as the language that one uses when looking up at a constellation and says, you know, that's the story of the bear that fell from the sky and ascended a tree of wisdom in order to spread, or whatever. I'm making it up, but a point being that when we speak in these sort of simultaneously abstract and concrete terms in the same breath, you know, we tell a definitive story. It's more definitive than Journey and the kind of Joseph Campbell take of just the hero travels into the world, absorbs life lessons, returns to spread the benefit of those lessons, and then transcends to the next level kind of thing. It's more concrete than that. It's more grounded than that, in the way that mythology has characters motivated to, you know, by whatever kinds of intrinsic characteristics they have, and then they go off and they do something, and we see that, and it's written in the stars or whatever. And I see this game as, imagine hearing a story like that and then being given a chance to play through what actually happened. So you see some of the fine-grained details, but you also see the just kind of larger-than-life, broad, abstract archetypes being described, which to me is It's actually quite unique amongst games, and it took me a long time to really understand what I just said. I didn't phrase it that way for the first several years of development. I didn't really know how to phrase it because it's a game that it really is simultaneously telling a concrete narrative that you play through in your own way. Yet it is very much this kind of abstract mythic tale that's plays by its own rules, you know, in its own world.
The world that Matt and the developers at Giant Squid have created is just so ancient feeling. I mean, it just feels as though it's been there forever. And your music really adds to that because you've brought in all of these incredible instruments from cultures all over the world. And so it's like pan-cultural. It's really hard to like narrow down. And yet it just feels like we've always known what this music should sound like. So,
well, that's very kind. I didn't quite know at the beginning exactly what would be the right approach. Funny enough, the theme, the actual kind of actual just baseline melody that forms the foundation of it all, which I have came to call None Have Returned, was there at the very beginning, you know, kind of like Abzu, kind of like Journey and the Banner Saga and a bunch of other games I've worked on, where I was able to find that pretty fast and then never really, you know, topped it or found something I liked better. But how it was expressed and what its function was and how everything connected to each other was just even a few months ago, there were large questions that I was grappling with and trying to really figure out how to nail. And so that whole kind of polyculturalism is almost an emergent property because I was just constantly feeling like I would do things and it would feel too intrinsically sort of alien or foreign. And I mean that with no sort of political overtone. I simply mean it would just it would just feel too unfamiliar to any average listener, to any, because it would just draw from things that are sort of too fringy. And then so, okay, I'd reel it back in and make it more folk-like. But that would then invariably pull it towards some very specific folk tradition. And so now it's too familiar, and it's also pointing too specifically at, oh, it's this, it's Japanese. Okay, well, no, I don't want it to be Japanese. Okay, well, now it's this. Well, now it's Celtic. Well, I don't really want it. Well, now it's Senegalese. Well, I don't really want it to be that either. And it's like, so as I kind of migrated around the world, I would gradually sort of pick up DNA from these experiments and then say, okay, well, I don't want it to actually be that thing, though, but I like the idea that it would feel like a descendant of that thing, or maybe the opposite, an early predecessor of that thing. It exists on some wavelength, some lineage with these various traditions, but they're all folded together in a way that no actual culture in the earth has. There is no place where you will find this specific blend of elements, and that was just arrived at slowly through the specific instruments and then even the musical vocabulary. And there's also, I think, plenty in there that's probably plain old me, which is always an X factor that I'm trying to control as well, of like, just how much do I let myself just kind of be myself, or how much am I actively trying to really step outside of myself and be something else? And I don't know the final result. It's just that it's an ongoing experiment.
It's so interesting because listening, you know, track by track by track, I can hear all of these incredible voices from all over the world. And then especially with the orchestral writing, that really does sound like you. It's kind of grounding too. And it keeps things from, you know, venturing off too far into, you know, unknown territory. And so I don't know if that was intentional. Yeah, but.
Well, you know, the orchestra, you know, there's really only sort of two components to it that I would call orchestral. There's the strings, of course, which I do largely use them the way I often use strings, you know, which is sometimes they're there to just add a warmth and to just expand the scope. It's like widening the lens or expanding the frame, you can think of it as, where there's a real intimacy to the to huge swaths of the score. You know, we have these instruments like the oud or the lute or the nickel harpa, you know, recorded from inches away, where it's just really meant to feel like it's inside your head and your ears are hearing it from the inside out almost, and not the other way around. But then the orchestra, by its very nature, does the opposite. It really does expand the palette. And so there's just plenty of moments. You call it cinematic if you want. You can, you know, call it, you know, grand and expressive or whatever. I would dare not use a word like epic. But it does mean to have that quality where you just, there are occasional moments where you really do want to make a large statement that feels like it just has a lot of mass. Strings are useful for that. They're also just, you know, there's just no denying the emotional power of that. And sometimes, you know, I'll make a statement in a very small and soloistic way, and then I'll want to say that similar thing, but on a grander scale. So, you know, we add the strings. there's also something very universal, even though the strings are very much a byproduct of, you know, sort of central and Western European classical music. They've been adopted by the vast majority of the world as a sound that can be easily repurposed to whatever we want. And so I think of them as also a kind of a neutral force that helps make it just kind of feel like human music, even though I know that that's not actually technically musicologically correct. I don't think that most people in the world would hear it and it feel alienating. And so there's that, it's a glue. But of course, the other element is there's this big French horn ensemble, which really is not, it's not really orchestral. And I don't use them the way, I tried to generally, a few exceptions, but generally don't really use them in the way that horns are typically used in the orchestra. You'll find no regal binary sunsets in here. It was actually, and that was, funny enough, that was an idea of Matt's that I kind of exploded into a place that he didn't really, I think, mean it, where, you know, he said, I love the idea of hunting horns. You know, our character is a hunter, but more than just that, there's a momentum. There's, you know, you think of like a British fox hunt where it's a fast-paced, very kind of darting sense, and you think of horns, and the idea of the French horn really stems from that, you know, this kind of almost bugle call in a way idea. And I started to run with that and thought, oh, it could be fun to have these sort of fanfare figures. And then very quickly it was, well, you know, what if I associate that explicitly with these big cursed beasts, you know, these demons, as it were, that you're trying to cleanse as part of the story of the game. And then this antiphonal idea of, well, let's put a bunch of horns on one side of the room and a bunch of horns on the other. And it's built around this idea of a call and response. And so once that kind of got into my head, I just started to run with it. And after about a year or whatever of writing horn parts like that, they had really grown into something that were just the wickedly hard parts, where very, very quick and darting, you know, this, and then the other side, and really like aggressively, much closer to the way you would probably safely write a trumpet part. But yeah, that just became this X factor that was really, by the time when you hear them, they're so different from all these other soloists that the hope was, at least, that it feels like, okay, we kind of understand this vocabulary, and then here is something that's just clearly outside of that. And that's kind of the whole point, is that there's this curse in the world. It's almost like a cancer. There's this thing that is just clearly an aberration that we're fighting against. And hopefully it feels like that. That's partly also why, until the very, 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 very end of the game, you will never hear... Well, I think there's one moment at the very beginning, intentionally, subtly, but only in the literal final boss fight, the finale of the game, do you ever hear the strings and the horns in the same cue. I intentionally always kept them separate from one another. Now, of course, the soundtrack album kind of blurs that distinction because I end up combining a lot of cues to form a track. Because, you know, bear in mind the actual score is hundreds and hundreds of smaller cues than that. I intentionally wanted it to always feel like you either hear the horns or the strings or neither, but you never hear horns and strings, because now that starts to sound like an orchestra. Now you're starting to hear these colors coexisting that one is used to coexisting. But if it's always kind of one or the other, it helps prevent it from being traditionally orchestral, which was explicitly the goal.
Yeah, it's a great, great sound. And I only have had the soundtrack to listen to so far. I haven't had a chance to see for myself, you know, what the game is like. But it's going to be incredible to experience that.
Have you heard the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
The whole album?
Yeah.
Well, that's very gracious for you to give me, you know, an hour and 40 minutes of your time like that. It's definitely one of the longer. I think it might actually be the longest album that I've released, because I tend to be very, very militant on my cuts. Mm-hmm. On the Pathless, there was also the interesting challenge that you spend most of your time exploring the island, and it's a very meditative and beautiful experience, even though it's fast-paced, and that's one of the things that I think is so beautifully unique about the game, is it's full of energy, even though it's still very relaxed in its way. You're not like scoring points. You can't die. You know, the things that make a giant squid, and in a way, sort of by extension, that game company, that lineage of Flower Journey Abzu, now the Pathless, that Matt Nava personally is. There's a real consistency. He has taken this somewhere that none of those other games go even remotely, by virtue of the fact that there's things like boss battles but it's not a game that's trying to test your skill or anything like that. It's not a platformer, despite the fact that there are puzzles that have light platforming. Like it's really a descendant of Journey and Abzu, even while forging boldly in a new territory. And the result of which is that you spend most of your time in this very introspective, meditative place. And so the score is very asymmetric in terms of the full 3 hours of music that I wrote, of between these absolutely rambunctious and totally over the top boss battle pieces fighting these monsters. And then the massive times in between those, as you uncover the landscape and lay the foundation to prepare yourself for those battles. And so the result is that you would have, like, if I just put the album exactly as it exists in game, which is not possible because of the interaction, but the interactivity, but pretending that it was, it would be like an hour of meditative, beautiful introspection followed by 5 minutes of chaos. And then and then another like 45 minutes. And to me, that was very imbalanced and very unpleasant as a listening experience. And so I very aggressively again cut material so that hopefully, and you tell me, you listen to it, you're among the first sort of virgin ears for it, but hopefully it feels like a relatively steady ebb and flow of those emotions, and it's not just supremely like over here, over here, over here, over here, quick hard left to this, back over here again. Did it feel more balanced to you?
Yeah, it really did. And what's so interesting too about the exploration music, you know, played off against the boss battle music, is the boss battles don't start super aggressively a lot of times, at least not all of them. I mean, you can tell that a boss battle is coming, but because of the way it ramps up, it's a nice segue from the exploration music to a boss battle.
It's, yeah, the way that it works in the actual game, we differentiate between what we call a chase and like a fight, to just, you know, use very kind of generic terms with it. But that is what I think that is what you're picking up on, is that there's kind of, you know, this sort of, you know, more meditative quality that gives way to a kind of scherzo galloping, you know, rush of energy, but it's still a little bit pretty, or it's still a little bit, it's not explicitly kind of dangerous yet. And then finally reaches these moments in the game where you are now kind of in an arena, and you actually have, there's no more running. You actually have to figure out how to defeat this thing. And so we try to sculpt that arc. And there's actually a lot of times on the album where I did things, I decided to just be incredibly shameless in my edits, and I remixed the music very heavily from what you'll hear in game in order to make those transitions sort of longer or more smooth, because, you know, it's very different to have the music coming, and then you land the shot with your bow and arrow, and that brings the chase to an abrupt halt. And the music is designed to account for that in game, but of course on an album it would feel very sudden. So we have to figure out how to kind of sculpt it a little bit more. And hopefully if you just played and then listened, you wouldn't actually really hear any of this. It just feels like, yeah, that's basically what I remember.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I would love to talk with you about how you planned out the music for the bosses, because I think one of the most interesting things that you've ever told me is that you sort of, starting with Assassin's Creed Syndicate, viewed boss battles as like a dance, like a complicated dance. And that was really, I could really hear that in Absolver too. And so I'm wondering what you did differently with this one. It still has that sort of rhythm, and it almost sounds like it's choreographed, but these battles are different. And is that because you can't die in them, kind of? Or?
That's an interesting take. I would happily own that take, though I wouldn't know that specific reason is why I latched onto that. I think it would be more broadly that in the case of Syndicate, the specific reason I liked to think of it as a dance was because there was something about the implication of a dance being safe, and there was something, I liked the therefore implicit arrogance of the characters, that you actually can die, but they're so sure they won't that it's this carefree waltz. Like, it's not even just any dance. It's like a dance that epitomizes a lack of danger. And that was the idea with Syndicate. I mean, there is something dance-like and beautiful and choreographic to, in a way, all video games. And I think that I just tend to like that. I tend to like the kind of ballet-ness of it. But Syndicate had a very specific narrative and sort of character reason why I latched onto it. And I think partly it just kind of got into my skin after that. And I just kind of fell in love with that idea so heavily that it seemed to just permeate everything from then on. Because in this case, there definitely is a sort of dance-like quality, although that's less born of, I think the whole game has that quality. The whole game has just this, one of the things that they aspired to was that it just feel like this effortless, continuous momentum. It should be a game where gliding and almost in a way surfing, even though it's not surfing obviously, but it should feel like that just carefree and utterly easy forward momentum. You don't have to work hard like you're slogging through the snow. I remember, funny enough, 2 years ago, almost exactly, not quite 2 years ago, December of 2018, they announced the game at the Game Awards and simultaneously announced Hades. And Darren came into town to as part of the super giant entourage, and he came and hung out here at my studio. I was finishing, I was midway through John Wick Hex, and I said I would love some of your feedback on this music, and I think that you might have some tricks to just make it better that I'm overlooking. And so he came and hung out, and we sat and we're going through the John Wick stuff. And he goes, by the way, I saw the trailer for The Pathless. He goes, I think it's the first time I've ever wanted to buy a game based on the animation of the character walking.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, wow, I'm going to make sure to tell Giant Squid that, because that's probably their number one goal, is that it feel like just movement as effortless as breathing. And so that lends itself, I think, to a dance-like quality as well.
Mm-hmm. No, it does. The gameplay that I've seen, she just moves so fluidly. Even when she's not flying with her eagle, she's still just gliding across the landscape and picking off targets and stuff like that. But yeah, there's this forward momentum that just is, it just carries things along.
You actually, funny enough, your character's movement speed, you can actually go quite a lot faster on ground running than with the eagle, which was a thing that they played with back and forth, and were fine tuning all the time, because what they found was that gliding with the eagle was so satisfying. And when it was so fast, players never spent any time on the ground ever. And so they were developing this elaborate world and secrets and puzzles and all this stuff in the ground, in the map, like in the island, and realizing that player, it was very easy to miss it because you just sailed above it. So they said it needs to be a trade-off where if you want to move fast, it's all about shooting and you know, because the targets, they're not hard to hit. It's deliberately very easy. It's not a skill-based thing. It's all about timing. And if you basically just hold the trigger, she'll never miss the target. So that you just, and the targets are how you gain your speed. And so as you just effortlessly move, you can zip around like, it's like the speeder bikes on Endor, you know, where you just narrowly going through all the trees. And they really designed it well so that you can't ever just, you know, hit a thing and just instantly grind to a halt. I mean, it's really like Assassin's Creed, that franchise at its best has always had that quality as well, where running and doing all the kind of parkour off buildings, and it's meant to just feel like if I just hold the controller forward, I'll never really hit a wall. It's always guiding me somewhere. Even it's an astonishing thing to do in an open world way where you don't know the direction anyone's running, because you basically have an infinite number of design challenges at that point. But the gliding is almost like a reprieve, not to mention the fact that, you know, the eagle can flap you up into the sky, and that's one of the things you kind of level up in the game is the eagles, how powerful those flaps can be and get to give you more altitude so that you can go just incredibly high. And there's something it's like skydiving that feels just very serene and beautiful and wonderful about that, as distinct from the super high energy, just flowing momentum of being on the ground. And all that, of course, led to all number of score challenges, because we really wanted to differentiate those experiences for the player. And the fact that you can shift gears within a fraction of a second made for some interesting challenges, you know, it's just because we don't want the music to just sort of vamp in the background. You know, it has to really have purpose, and it was not easy.
Yeah, well, one of the things that must have been a challenge, and this has been the case with Journey and Abzu too, the player plays a character that isn't really fleshed out. They don't speak. You don't really know what their personalities are like. So what sort of challenges did these sort of, you know, tabula rasa kind of characters pose for you with like emotion and stuff?
I mean, I've always liked that. I've always liked that about characters that are a blank canvas for you to kind of project onto. Journey is, in many respects, the ultimate epitome of that, because the character is so deliberately designed, especially with regard to other players, you know, that you encounter online in the game. There's a real conscientious anonymization of the character so that they just become this avatar of you or something else, maybe. I mean, plenty of other characters project loved ones onto their own player character and that kind of thing. In the case of the Pathless, she actually does speak, but very sparingly. And then there's this other character that's, you know, they kind of refer to as the God Slayer that you see, that's kind of the nemesis, the villain of the game. And he speaks, but it's very few lines. Funny enough, they had placeholder voices for these characters for 2 years or something. In fact, Steve Green, the in-house sound designer and kind of de facto audio director for Giant Squid, was voicing one of the characters himself for a while, and it was all just kind of temporary. And then Matt came to me and said, the characters are just meaty enough in their writing that we really should have a proper actor. Do you know anyone? And I was like, as a matter of fact. So I called up Troy Baker and I said, how would you like to voice a God Slayer? And so he did it. So Troy is our villain. And then I said, would you be interested in directing for The Hunter? And who would you cast? And he said, Laura Bailey. And so we have Laura is the hunter, and it's they speak a completely made up language that Steve developed. That's very conscientiously this amount, much like the score and much like the environment of the world and all the cultural references in the world. It's an amalgam of languages in many respects. He took some pointers from Kevin Ragamy and the made up Slavic Rushlish, as we called it, from Tooth and Tail. That we had there as well, and it's sort of saying how do we invent a language that actually does have underlying rules like a real language, and so there is that which was really cool. I was really happy to, because as close of friends of Troy and I are, and he's truly one of my absolute best friends. We talk every single day. We'd only ever sort of been involved in one game prior, which was John Wick Hex, where he plays Hex. And it's funny because the irony, you know, the joke with him is that he's been in every game. He's
yeah.
He is every character. And Laura's not far behind. I mean, you know,
yeah.
the two of them come out, you know, this summer as Joel from The Last of Us and Abby from The Last of Us. And then hot on the heels of that, you know, he's Bruce Banner and she's Black Widow in Crystal Dynamics' Avengers game. And on and on and on and on the list goes. Plus they're in all kinds of animated stuff together, and so you're like, and we're doing also this musical Chorus. She's our lead in that as well, so you know, been able to get to know her a bit through those avenues, but it was really cool to be able to bring in and have some real just like top of the top pros voice these lines. As minimal as they are, those lines are done with brilliant conviction, which was really exciting.
Wow, that's so cool.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated by how you use that Tuvan ensemble. I am a real sucker for throat singing. I just there's something just so like elemental about it, and the harmonics and everything.
And there's nothing like it. It's one of those few musical traditions that is what it is and is nothing else. You know, like you think of Appalachian fiddle playing, like that dovetails with a bunch of other stuff, right? Like there's a lot of there are a lot of societies that use violins or very similar instruments, you know. So you hear that, and it's only a few steps away from other things you might be familiar with, but there's just nothing like throat singing. And there's only a few places in the world that have really kind of mastered it, Tuva being one of the, you know, one of those very few, Mongolia and the Inuits in you know, North America, and like the frozen north of North America. It's very rare and very unique. And so, yeah, with those guys, what happened there was I was connected with the Alash Ensemble through the Fifth House Ensemble, because they were doing a kind of joint residency where, you know, Fifth House Ensemble are the musicians that I've performed Journey live with every time. They are the sole performers of that show. And so, and they've also commissioned concert works of me, and including a piece that uses the Alash Ensemble and Fifth House side by side on stage, which was an interactive piece actually that involved a dice game for the audience to play that drove what happened in the music. So they planted them in my like radar because they told me, you know, we're going to be doing this residency, and Fifth House went to Tuva as part of this as well. They you know, the guys came to the US and they did some shows with Fifth House together, and then they switched and went and sent members of Fifth House to Tuva. So I knew all this was on its way, and because the Mongolian tradition of falconry was a big inspiration for Matt, I knew that I had a suspicion that throat singing would be very welcome. And I loved the idea. I like pushing against sort of gender norms, you know, like it's always very funny to me. I didn't even really intend it to be an example of that, but when I associated the cello of Tina Guo with Evie Fry in Assassin's Creed Syndicate and the violin with Jacob Fry, played by Sandy Cameron, people were like, oh, that's cool, you're kind of doing a gender reversal thing. And I was like, is cello intrinsically masculine? I mean, yes, it's a deeper instrument. I suppose it is a baritone relative, it's tenor instrument, to be fair, to be relative to the violin's soprano. But still, to me, the idea of strings being gendered was alien. But I liked that people projected a reversal, just because I thought, oh, that what that means is that they had an expectation and I managed to sidestep it. And at the end of the day, that I enjoy doing, regardless of whatever baggage I unintentionally stepped into to cause it. But knowing that, I did find myself thinking, throat singing is there are women who can do it, but it is overwhelmingly dominated. When you hear it, it's almost always it's a very masculine thing, because it is, of course, also very deep most of the time. And these Alash guys can sing. I've never heard notes that low come out of a human being before. I mean, it's like tectonic plates vibrating. I mean, it's just so, like you said, elemental is a great word for it. And I liked the idea I specifically use it as a kind of proxy for the hunter. To me, they are her in many ways in the story, because I liked the idea that, not to be spoilery, but there is a kind of, in the story of the game, there's this notion of she comes to the island not really knowing why she's there, and it's kind of a rite of passage for her people or something like that, and there's a certain finding of one's purpose. And so I build in the throat singing more and more and more and more as she starts to kind of realize why she's there. I wanted it to be a way that you feel the point of all of this coming into focus. So anyway, all that said, I didn't know any of that at the beginning. I didn't know how I would use them. I just knew that it was a sound that I found beautiful. I'd always wanted to find a way to incorporate it into something. And it just seemed a natural fit for a lot of reasons here. The challenge was how to collaborate with them. You know, they can read sheet music okay, But it's just not how they're musicians who are, you know, their tradition is primarily a folk tradition that is built very heavily around improvising with each other and responding and kind of dialoguing, as it were, in real time. And so they were in New York City. This was over 2 years ago now. We did like a test recording where I did, you know, some very simple mock-ups and some very simple kind of charts, put it in front of them. And then I also was like, how about you just sort of play? And it was only for like an hour just to kind of test the waters. So I was just listening in over Skype. But I kept thinking, man, this would be so easy. I would ask for a thing and they'd kind of say, is this what you mean? No, not really that. What about this? Can you hear me here? No, I can't really hear. And the other translator was there, and you know they speak English a little, and obviously I speak zero Tuvan, and so there was a bit of a language barrier, but they were troopers and really trying to kind of explore. But it was just really obvious that if I really want to communicate, I should communicate with notes. So I got on the phone with their manager and translator, and I said, "When are you? Can you just show me when and where you'll be?" And he sent me their full touring calendar, which was booked. I mean, they live on the road. I was blown away. And they had shows all over, everywhere. Europe and US and Canada and South America. And it just seemed like they were always on the move. And so I happened to find a date. I was sort of triangulating my life. And I was finishing this score, Erica. And I knew I needed to be in Nashville recording this ensemble of basses that we did for that score. And they were going to be in Washington, D.C. like the next day. So I was like, oh, well, I'm practically to Washington, D.C. if I'm in Nashville. So we doubled up the session. So I flew to Nashville, recorded Erica, and then shifted gears dramatically. You know, Erica was only a few months from release, but Pathos, I knew, was give or take a year from release. Or 2 years. At that point, I thought it was maybe about a year. It ended up extending, and it ended up being about 2 years, which thank God for that. I used every extra second I had. But I knew I still had a ways to go. And at some point I was like, okay, you know, there are some very, very, very rudimentary sample libraries of throat singing that I can use if I really just want it as a texture. But I didn't really want it as a texture. I thought that's such a generic and stupid way to use it. And it also is, in a way, disrespectful of the artistry of what it really is. It's not a sound. It's not like wind that you just drop in because it's a cool effect. Like, it's a real, it has purpose. They're different, and the wide range of colors that they can make with their voices, never mind their instruments, which is a whole other amazing thing. And so we booked this long full day at a session at a studio, a little tiny studio that does like pop albums and rock albums and stuff and some jazz, and a little small studio in Washington, D.C. And I said, here's what I'd like. I want a digital piano in the middle of the room, and I want these guys basically all around me. And so it's like a circle. But I'm in the center, and I will have a piano that they can hear in their headphones, but which is not acoustic. I want it to not be in the room, because I don't want my piano to be part of this. I just want to be able to communicate with them. And so I would sit there at the piano and I'd start playing an idea, and they would listen. And then, like, you know, the Dashpalur is the thing that is almost like a banjo. And so he'd start playing. And then, you know, body would look and start singing, or one would, you know, reach over and grab his, there's a sort of flute-like instrument that they play, or the, you know, the eagle, which is kind of like the Mongolian Morin Kur, like a horse head fiddle. And they just start to riff, and we just jam for like 25 minutes and just make little variations. Then I'd put little harmonic twists and see what they do. And they would do the same. And it just, without speaking, we just play and play and play. And then I'd say, okay, that's cool. Now let's do all that, but faster. So then stop and just start double timing it. And played without stopping, without ever turning off the mic, for six and a half hours. Just built up this massive, and we played in every key you can think of, and every a million different tempos. And then had this, just basically this catalog of everything I could think of, but it was all contextual to the Pathless. Like, I had the story and I had the character in my mind, and it wasn't random playing. I was trying to guide the event, the performance, through the emotions of the story, but letting it get heavily modulated by their playing. So they kind of told the story with me. And then I went and I just pulled that and I built the whole score off. I treated that like, okay, this is now my spine, or this is even the full skeleton, and I want to build up from here and really make this the heart and soul of it. And it was a massive editorial challenge. In fact, I remember I gave the Pro Tools session to my assistant Dallas, and I was like, I need you to basically go in here, and every time we change keys, I need you to mark it, and every time we change tempos, I need you to mark it, so that I can have like, okay, what's close to 140 BPM, and you know, and I'll go there and go, okay, well, it looks like I have, you know, I have B, I have D minor, I've got E flat in those keys, and then I'd go and I'd start writing the cue, knowing like, okay, these are the variables that I have set from this performance. And so virtually the whole score was built from the ground up of that day in the studio with those guys. It was really funny because the game doesn't really, you could easily finish the game in under 6 hours or comfortably around 6 hours. So it was funny when, at the time though, they were projecting more like 2 to 3 hours because it was still relatively early. You know, it was more than two and a half years ago that we did this session. And I remember saying, we just played for like twice as long as the whole game. And that's no longer quite true, but it was definitely the perception at the time, and it made me laugh. But I didn't use every last little note that we played, but I used just tons and tons and tons and tons of it. I've never done a score like that. I've never liked using improvisation as a composition tool because there's something sort of intrinsically lazy about that in my mind. But I think it really opened my eyes to the idea that I was not thinking about the full potential of what improvisation can mean. Improvisation as a dialogue is very different from just sitting and stream of consciousing a bunch of ideas out and then presuming that they're good simply because they came out.
Now, I was just going to say, no wonder it sounds so authentic, because it's the way that they would have performed in concert, probably, or just in Mongolia or Tuva. And so it has a really just, yeah, earthy, grounded quality to it that just feels really authentic.
There were a few times where I played like a single note, basically just to establish what key we were in. And then I said, can you just play? And they would just, like I said, I just want to hear some folk songs that you guys, that are like known, it's not even really improvising, but it is, because you improvise around familiar little tunes and ideas, you know, much the way like, you know, jazz musicians will play a song, and you'll recognize, you'll hear the threads of that song intermittently, but then they'll explore way afield of it before coming back to it. It's in many respects very similar. They don't stick to a script, even though it is a song that they know. And there were a lot of times where I said, I just want to sit and bask in that. And I also wanted to make sure that I wasn't telling them what to do. I didn't want it to be, I'm not writing for you. You're not studio musicians. We're really creating together, but in a way you're guiding me. I'm making sure that I have the fundamental tool set that I know I will need functionally, but I also can adapt my tool set to what we end up with. Like if it turns out that it's just, I wanted X, Y, Z, but X and Y are the things that really feel the best because they're themselves being their most authentic self, then let's just get rid of Z. I don't, at that point, I'm not interested. That's why that first recording in September 2018 in New York City didn't use any of that in the score. Even though they played beautifully, I was trying to push them somewhere that it was just so obviously born of me still ingesting how they think and how they feel and learning what that authenticity really is. I wasn't steeped in it enough yet. And so it's more forced. It didn't really resonate with those recordings by comparison to the later ones.
Yeah, because I was really curious about that process and when what guides what with these instruments that we're not really familiar with, and that's such an interesting process. And I love how you've dovetailed it with the sound of the nickel harpa, because that has overtones too, and so that's just such an amazing combination.
Yeah, and that instrument is such a, I call it a steampunk viola, because it's so clattery, and it makes so much noise when he plays it, you know, all these keys and moving parts and the strings, you know, he bumps the strings, and then there's all these sympathetic strings, and you know, sometimes he'll bump those, and it's just the nature of the instrument. It's built. I was talking to someone the other day, and I said, in a way, the nickel harpa to me feels like, even though it's beautiful and it's ornate and it has that kind of almost baroque sense of just immaculate little infinite fractal details, it also kind of looks like the way characters in the Star Wars universe look at the Millennium Falcon. You know, we look at the Millennium Falcon and we see it as a spaceship. And so we just marvel at the idea of a ship that can take off from a planet and then jump to faster than light speeds. And to us, what a technological marvel. But in a universe where that's commonplace and mundane, the Millennium Falcon is actually a junker that everybody looks at and goes, I'm amazed it works. And like, it's incredible that it's apparently so fast and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you never forget Luke's first reaction where he looks at that and goes, what a piece of junk. And he's so dismissive of it. Hans is so defensive. To me, I look at a nickel harp, but kind of like that, where I say it's, on the one hand, yes, it's incredibly beautiful and it's powerful, but it also kind of feels like it's being held just barely together. And I absolutely loved the kind of intrinsic rusticness as a result. And it really felt connected, even though it's in a way very sophisticated piece of engineering, especially considering that it's hundreds of years old. It's not exactly a modern instrument. It still has that kind of primal quality from something that's barely functional, you know, it feels like it's just one breath away from turning to dust. And I loved that about it, and was very lucky to find this musician, this young player, Morgan O'Shaughnessy, because there are very few people that play it, particularly in L.A. My original fantasy, I wanted four of them playing as a quartet, and getting there's really only two or three people in L.A. that play it, and getting their schedules in line with it. And one of them, I think, moved away in the middle of the project. So I just said to Morgan, you know, I'm going to just rely on overdubbing you, because there's a lot of multiple nickel harpa parts in parallel throughout the score, and it's all just him overdubbing himself, which was not what I wanted to do, because when you listen to them together, all the complex overtones really gel together, and it sounds two or three of them together, even in unison, never mind playing in harmony with one another, but as unison parts, it sounds like 50 musicians. It's just so, but all just ever so slightly out of tune with each other in a way that I found just absolutely beautiful. And that I was not able to do. We'll find another excuse to make that happen on a different score someday. Because that when I found videos on YouTube, for example, of like little nickel harpa consorts, I just found it the most intoxicatingly beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And that I was not able to do. But I still, we found a workaround that I'm happy with.
Yeah, because it sounds, it like I say, it's this sort of, again, kind of raw sound. It always... And I don't know if it's just me picturing the Swedish landscape in wintertime, but it really, really has this kind of bleak and lonely sound.
It's like the Baroque strings, like the Viol da Gamba, or you know, that score I did, Pode, featured heavily this similar Norwegian instrument called the Hardanger fiddle, which all, one of the things that they all have in common is that virtually none are played with vibrato, which give them this very piercing, very instant sound. You know, there's no warmth really to it. They're not overly cold, but they're like little daggers. And yeah, it can make it very challenging to mix, because even pianissimo, it just cuts through everything. And so, you know, it's really, you know, I remember Matt flagging that early as well and saying, we want to make sure that this doesn't feel like nickel harpa and others at all times. Because, you know, the nickel harpa, originally I had thought maybe the nickel harpa would be what Kristen's oboe is to Abzu, or Tina's cello is to Journey, like really foundationally the basis of it all. But that whole sort of global jam band emerged as, no, this is more equal opportunity than that. There are some instruments that I favor for certain specific narrative reasons, and you know, the throat singer and that sort of thing, and you know, throat singing of the Alosh guys, but by and large, it's about the gelling of the group as the sound.
Yeah, and what's so cool about those dozens and dozens of instruments that Kristen brought to the soundtrack is a lot of them, you know, they cross so many cultures, and the flutes and the whistles show up in the music of a lot of different cultures, so that kind of holds everything together too. So she's just so awesome.
She is one of my favorite people, and one of my favorite little things about this is that so often when we work together, she's recording from home. You know, there have been a couple of times where that's not the case. You know, there were a few cues. Actually, now that I think about it, it just dawns on me that this is the only score I've worked on with her that we recorded across three different cities, because there are a couple of cues that she recorded here in my studio when she was in town for like E3 or something in some years past, or you know, passing through after GDC or so. She makes a kind of relatively frequent pilgrimage through LA, and I managed to snag her on one of those trips, I believe. And then she also records from home in Florida the bulk of the time, especially because she has so many different instruments that it's obviously unfeasible to travel with most of them. But one fun thing that I'll cherish forever was that when Darren and I collaborated on his Supergiant album and made this kind of retrospective of his work that we recorded at Abbey Road, you know, and we did it initially at PAX, and I said we planned this whole thing, and I produced the album to do it in London at Abbey Road, and we flew her to play with us. You know, we said, look, there's no shortage of amazing woodwind players in London, and even though there's duduk parts and penny whistle parts and never mind flute, clarinet, oboe parts, all of which she plays, all those could be sourced in London, but they really were written for her, and she has played them at PAX, and she, you know, were very loyal to her. So Supergiant flew her to London to record at Abbey Road, and I paired that trip up with my recordings for the Pathless. So we recorded in Darren's for a few days, and then, you know, Darren went off to go have fun in London with his family and Ashley and whatever, and I stayed at Abbey Road and kept recording for the Pathless. And so Kristen stuck around, and we were able to record some of her Pathless solos at Abbey Road as well, which was just so cool to be able to, you know, have this trifecta of cities and time zones across 3 years worth of recording sessions with her. So yeah, she is a gift.
Yeah, and just the whole process of putting this thing together is incredible. And you did round up some of your company of your merry band of Tom Straley is there with the oud and a lute, and they must really love performing your music. I mean, because it kind of like really pushes them to do new stuff.
Tom in particular is always game for a challenge, and there's almost an arms race going on at this point where you know, he'll say, I just bought this instrument and I really don't know how to play it, and I'll go, perfect, and then I'll write these ludicrously hard parts for it. And so he'll send me, he'll leave little notes to me, we'll say charitably, in the recording, you know, because he'll also record the majority of these from home. And then I'll find little, like, I'll see the audio file of the recording and then the silence, and then there'll be a little something. And it'll be him whispering under his breath, like, Austin. Sometimes it's very sweet. Like, I get these little love notes, but then other times I can feel that he's like, this one almost killed me. but yeah, no, he's always game to just learn and expand and grow. And what I love is that Tom can really, he can be this amazing Swiss Army knife where, like in the case of the lute, you know, there is a whole lute tradition, but I wasn't trying to write lute music. I wanted the color of the lute and I wanted the inflection of its tradition, but I also wanted to write parts that no lute player would ever have played. You know, I wanted to be able to bring that color somewhere. And I mean, I did that with all of them. You know, like the nickel harpa plays plenty of things that are way outside the nickel harpa tradition and et cetera, et cetera. And that was part of the point, is to take these instruments somewhere new, but also let them bring us somewhere new through their kind of their natural tendencies.
Thank you.
that was a blast, you know, having kind of my normal cadre of folks. Paul Cartwright, who I work with a fair amount as well, you know, he put some very thick, oversized strings on a violin that we kind of referred to as a baritone violin, where it can play a full octave lower than a normal violin, which places it somewhere between a viola and a cello as a result. It's actually lower than a viola, but it's on a violin. And so we kind of, you know, quasi-invented an instrument there, because I was originally trying to write for a different instrument and I could not find anybody that played it. And the one person I found who did said, these parts are too hard for me. It's not really my main instrument, so I can't help you. So I thought, okay, well, crap. I have all these parts written for a stringed instrument. And then I called Paul and said, you know, you play everything. Because he's kind of like Kristen, but for stringed instruments. You know, he plays them all. And including a bunch you've never heard of. Like on Pode, there's two Hardanger fiddles. He's the other one. Rachel Nesvig being, because she's an actual Hardanger fiddler. And that was the idea, can I put these two instruments together? One who does it as, you know, her first language, one who's learning on the fly. What if they improv off each other? What happens then? That was the foundation of Pode. So he's someone I've just learned I can go to all the time, and he's brilliant and just an outstanding musician. And then like Eric Snoza, who I'd never worked with before outside of the context of performing Journeying Live, you know, as a founding member of Fifth House and outrageously talented bass player. You know, I thought, I don't really ever hear virtuoso bass parts, and boy, can he do it. And he sent me once a recording that I don't think he's ever actually released, where he did a all bass cover of I Was Born for This, where he's playing the violin parts on his bass and he sang the vocal part, which was also pretty awesome. And he sent me this recording and it blew my mind. I said, it's, you know, people really underestimate bass. And I've always tried to give basses something meaty, but this was a whole other level. And so, yeah, I was like, I need you to be a soloist for this thing. You know, like I need you to be a star performer of this score. And he's heavily featured. So,
wow.
Yeah.
It's just the whole thing. There's like 104 musicians in all, right?
104. I mean, you know, obviously so 50 of those are the strings.
Yeah, but still.
You know, it's not that 104 soloists, but it is overwhelmingly a lot of small groups or one-off performers. I for the ending credits song that I wrote, there's a kind of ghostly choir behind Oyonga's lead vocals, and so I got, you know, Troy to sing in that. Darren sings in that. Maluka sings in that. Peter Hollins' voice is in there. And, you know, there's this wonderful community of musicians that do like covers, like Adriana Figueroa. There's another cool thing where last year when I was finishing Erica, I did a contest where I put the theme to Erica with no context, and the game hadn't even been announced. So no one knew what this was for. I just put the sheet music and a single piano, one note at a time, of here's the theme, and knowing nothing about it, I'd love to hear your version of it. And for the ones that I like the most, we will find a way to work on some unnamed future project together. Well, hundreds of people did covers. And as you might expect, since they knew nothing about the game, they ranged massively. And so I ended up choosing three to be performers on the Pathless as well. One is this amazing guitarist from South America named Enoch, who had done covers of my music before. I recognized his name as soon as the cover showed up. And he's just such a fabulous guitarist. And so I thought, I really would love to feature some proper... He's not Spanish, but it's like he plays, you know, that sort of Spanish or almost flamenco tradition, or almost, you know, Argentinian in a way. And phenomenal musician. And so I featured him. And then there's this one young woman who lives in Rome named Samatis, who had done, she committed so hard to her cover of Erica that she actually put it on an album of video game music covers, that because she does these sort of one woman Celtic choir things. And she did a whole album of that Materia put out that she just included her Erica cover in. So I featured her as a vocalist in the score as well. And then the really unusual one was this guy named Bastian, who I think lives in France. And hopefully if he hears this, forgive me if I'm remembering wrong. But he did a performance where he did this very processed sound of himself humming that was unlike anything I'd ever heard. And I end up using that as like a central sound of this villain character of the God Slayer, because it was just the most alien and bizarre thing I'd ever heard. And it was so fascinating. So he's heavily featured, and it's all, you know, basically contest winners off this thing that they had no idea what they were even doing. They didn't know what it was for or anything, and just showed up with these fantastic colors. And so it's like every musician in a way has their own little kind of story like that. It's something personal, or there's very few people where it's just like, you play this, so you'll do.
Wow. It's just, I love that it's this like really global effort to create this incredible soundtrack. And you know, it's always fun to talk with you. I mean, we could just go on and on.
Pleasure is absolutely mine. No, sorry to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we're, you know, I feel like I just kind of am spinning off for eternity here and long abandoning your questions. I hope I haven't filibustered anything you wanted to get to.
Not at all. Is there anything I didn't get to?
Oh, well, no, it's your show. I am your guest, and I humbly submit myself as such.
Well, it's always fun. The soundtrack is just phenomenal. And thank you, Austin, so much for your time.
It is always a privilege. I remain, and on behalf of my composer colleagues, I know I speak on their behalf, that just your continued support of what we do. We're a very small community, even within the world of games. You know, we're a relatively niche discipline, and even though gamers pound for pound are way more appreciative of what we do relative to the average film buff, for example, and film soundtracks, still, if it were not for people like you, who really sort of put a microscope to it and actually give us a platform to say more than just five sentences of, oh, it was really fun. You know, who doesn't want to record at Abbey Road? And then that's it. That's the end of the discussion. You know, I was just ever grateful that you are just always making time for these conversations and giving us a welcoming home. So I say it extremely grateful to you from myself, and just for your friendship and your smiling face at all these events time and again. Especially now, I'm very all the more appreciative of that as the months stretch since we've been able to do these kinds of things. You really do show up. You know, you're always there at GDC and PAX and the rest of it, and just so grateful for that. But I know all my colleagues feel the same.
Oh, that means a lot. Thank you so much. And hopefully we'll see each other soon in person. That'd be great. Amar kutu.